You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is Wednesday, the 9th of February, 2022. This date is significant for a couple of reasons. The main one, though, is that I'm going to be getting married very soon. I haven't been talking about it much, this is something, of course, a new chapter in my life. Some of you who've known me a long time know what I've been through. And the good news is that, I've said this before, but, you know, I think there's probably a tiny handful of women who are good for a decent man. I mean, you know, 10 or 12, maybe. She's the only one. Maybe I took the only one. I don't know. But, she's one of our people in every way. She's coming along very nicely. And believe it or not, I am now the father of two dogs. Not just any dog, but dogs without fur. Deliberately. It's not like they have cancer or something. They deliberately have no fur. Well, I don't know. That's all I have to say. You know that I've lost my Facebook account a long time ago, and my PayPal. And you know what this all means. But for those of you, and there's a few of you, that would rather send me a check or a money order or cash, rare coins, your watch, whatever it might be, I do have a post office box, finally. My wife-elect, as she's known, set up P.O. Box 304, Tire Hill, Pennsylvania, 15959. And now you can use that. The universe could use that for whatever it needs in terms of getting in touch with me and anything you need to send me that's not electronic. I, as always, have a distasteful job to talk about my financial situation. My health insurance, just to give you one example, has gone up by 240% this year. I still don't have hot water. And yet, you know, this is what can only be considered a full-time job. We suffer with amateurism. We suffer with people who have opinions with no knowledge. They might be right, but usually for all the wrong reasons. This is not something to be taken very lightly. Besides this, and of course, you know, the money is an absolute necessity. They shut us out of every possible institutional connection. That's not done from a position of strength. It's done from a position of tremendous insecurity on their part. They have to spout a line strictly. They can't deviate it even a little bit. We are their antipode. We are far freer than they are. They have traded their reason for some version of comfort. As we've seen with people like Ellen and Whoopi Goldberg, even being a fanatical supporter of the regime will not guarantee you a position. We had a roundtable a few days ago on this question. I talked about Ukraine, of course. The other guys spoke of this Whoopi matter, and the brainwashing that's going on. And I pointed out, during the Russian Civil War, the Bolsheviks would purge huge numbers of their own forces on the grounds that fanaticism and internal cohesion was far more important than numbers. And we all know that that's correct. Numbers don't mean anything. Numbers are zombie-like. They don't matter. What matters is fanaticism, and that's what's happening to the left now. They're getting rid of anybody who possibly might be considered a threat, even within their own ranks. We have no organized resistance to give. And we have some people with money who are doing nothing with it. And I don't blame them. They're doing nothing with it because there's no one to give it to. You can't be a leader of this movement. We have no institutions. We have absolutely nothing to use against the Republican-Democrat juggernaut. And the regime is far more powerful than those idiots. They say the same things. They mean the same things. Especially the Republicans are terrified of their own shadow. They lose every fight they ever get involved in, militarily or otherwise. And are, they simply say it in different ways. So, that being said, the notion of ideological uniformity is important. And today, we're going to talk about a variation of that. And that's something, I did a lecture on this ages ago, but now I have a different angle. We're going to talk about the gulags. The gulag camps, this is what the West fought Hitler, to make certain that the gulags can spread from Berlin to the Far East, and then create Mao, and then create Ho Chi Minh, necessitating the Korean and Vietnam War. Isn't it wonderful? We're going to talk about three uprisings in the gulag that received no support from anywhere, either within or without the Soviet Union, despite the Western world pouring money and attacking South Africa for their segregationist policies, which were adopted out of necessity. These inhuman camps, uprisings, were ignored or even condemned by the Western newspapers. Usually they were simply ignored out of ignorance. Some of you know the Gulag is, in English, the acronym for the Main Directorate of Corrective Labor Camps. And in the Russian, to spell it using Latin letters, you would do a capital G, capital U, capital L, and then a lowercase a-g. Lageri is the final word. That's where the L-A-G comes from. It existed. One of the great myths of academic history is that this was strictly a Stalinist thing. It is not. That was the Gulag system was a part and parcel of Lenin's government all the way up to Gorbachev. It wasn't dismantled really until at the earliest, the early 80s. The Western left, which is the West, which is the Western political regime, it's leftist. It's no different than the Soviet functioned, Soviet Union functioned ideologically speaking. Anyway, the point being, this was done for the sake. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot what I was talking about. I have dogs behind me, the hairless dogs going bonkers. Stanley's somewhere, here he is. And Marcel is in the bedroom for some reason. So, that's all gone. Now I could focus. The great academic myth that this was strictly a Stalinist thing. This is how they supported the Soviet Union from day one. They consider Stalin a right-wing deviation, which is completely made up, of course. I've proven that 1,000 times. And so it's okay to support the USSR because it was just the 30s. Now, of course, the persecutions, the purges, the gulag system is a part of all materialistic systems, Soviet communism being just one. And it existed right up until Gorbachev's era. It was a means to control the dissident population, and as time went on, by Stalin's death, we talked about the post-Stalin era, by Stalin's death, it was responsible for maybe 15 to 20% of all economic output in the USSR. These are a series of the thousands of them, really, forced labor camps for enemies of the Soviet regime, and you did have common criminals there. Millions were killed from starvation, firing squad, disease, hunger. A non-Russian who was an inmate for some time, Jacques Rossi, he describes the gulag this way. He says it's something conceived in order to transform human matter into a docile, exhausted, ill-smelling mass of individuals living only for themselves and thinking of nothing else but how to appease the constant torture of hunger, living in the instant, concerned with nothing apart from evading kicks, cold, and ill treatment. That's not too far from what a zombie is. But so many of the methods, the way that the gulag system functioned, we can't talk about uprisings until we have some conception of what the gulag system was. I have a list of a few things used to maintain control and power, but things that could also be used on a macro scale. In other words, the regime uses these kind of things all the time, just not in a prison system, but it can be translated into a national or subnational level. A lot of these methods of control had a strong psychological component. This is what made the Soviet regime a little different from what had come before. It was a tiny Jewish sect with plenty of Gentile hangers-on who knew they had no right to rule, who didn't believe the slogans that they promoted. They were aware of what this was. It was a scam to skim the work of Russian labor. Russian capital has been built over centuries and put it in the pocket of the party. And simply by claiming that somehow party ownership of capital was the same thing as workers' control, they lived this fantasy world. And of course, Tito in Yugoslavia made a mockery of this. But using psychology was something new. The combination of psychological and physical is what made the gulag what it was. Humiliation was very important, especially using nudity, mocking remarks from guards, especially female guards if they're men. The broader purpose, of course, was to destroy the entire sense of the victim's sense of self. Now you could see how that could function on a national level. And they were used usually in parallel. One means, a very important one, and Solzhenitsyn talks about it, is starvation. Starvation isn't just a fact of not having the, we're not talking about Cannibal Island in Tomsk here. Prisoners in the gulag received their rations only in accordance with how much labor they performed according to these handful of guards. At the very maximum, it was barely enough for survival. And then that would be even less if a guard would be considered too lazy or if he were simply unpopular. This meant that all prisoners were slowly starving to death. Other torture methods were made more effective by very poor rations. I mean, the food for inmates was a very poor quality, rotten. So you had, you know, more or less half-starved prisoners. They would eat animal entrails and other unappetizing things, including each other in some cases, in Siberia especially. So eating at that level of starvation, eating becomes involuntary. This is where cannibalism comes from. It's not a rational thought. You simply become an animal, and you'll eat anything you can. Now, the brain is well aware how vile this so-called food is, but the eating process is automatic. And, of course, the second big one is sleep deprivation. This is how you make them more suggestible. This is how an interrogator will make someone confess to a crime. It is a means of torture, and it broke down all forms of resistance. Having bright lights on all the time. Arms could never be outside the victim's blanket while on his hard bunk, for example, so you couldn't keep warm. Didn't matter how crowded these cells were, sleep was impossible anyway, even under decent condition. So sleep deprivation leads to hallucinations and false memory. This is how they got confessions out of people, and confessions about others. Then over time, it leads to permanent mental illness. So a nasty version of this torture with a seat like an extremely sleep-deprived victim on a very nice soft sofa, making the inmate want to sleep all the more, and then, of course, push them off and send them back. All the tortures here were always coupled with both sleep deprivation and starvation. Those two were the foundation. And, of course, noise. Deafening was a method of torture. So interrogators would use megaphones to blast out eardrums. They would they would try to come close to rupturing them, but not go all the way. Very, very effective. Immobility. Solzhenitsyn talks about this in some length. prisoner is seated in a stool in a hallway for days and days and days, and he's not allowed to get up. He can't support his back. He cannot sleep. 6 days was, according to Solzhenitsyn, the record that he saw. When you think about how horrible that is. The most vile, the bedbug box. You see this in the Gulag Archipelago as well. The box was just big enough to stand in. It's like a small closet. And then they pour dozens of bedbugs into it. And the victim essentially was just there to feed them. The bugs had not been permitted to feed for days before that, and then the victim, who's already starving and exhausted, would fought the bugs off for a time, and then he would eventually let them feed on him passively. This may not be a big shock to you, understanding how the regime works. The swan dive is probably the most creative and the most painful, I would say. Again, Solzhenitsyn talks about it. It comes from the northern camps. NKVD agent named Lvakov in 1940. Again, Solzhenitsyn says this. So, it's a long piece of cloth inserted between the teeth of the victim. The ends were brought over his shoulders and then tied near his feet, his heels. The victim would then, like a wheel, have to lie on his stomach for days with no food. And then 2 days was the usual duration. And the pain was extreme. It's odd to even consider. And you have things like feet beat. There's something about beating the soles of the feet. It's had a long history. Because the lower part of the leg starts to hemorrhage massively. It feels like there's boiling water being poured on your feet long after the beating is over. There's something particularly sensitive about the bottom of the foot. And of course, freezing. The point was to force the victim to choose between warming up with physical activity in a cell or sleeping in extreme temperatures. One of the two. So one talks about, you know, running around the cell to get warm, then collapse from exhaustion, only then to get up again a few minutes later when the cold became too intense. So when you have rations that are very poor, labor very hard, the prisoner could only stand so much of this before permanent damage was inflicted. And this is what their whole, the punishment cell, was to use part of the cold to inflict pain. Most of these prisons were in the far north. So using the cold was an important method of punishment, control, and discipline. The cold punishment was a small closet, simply unheated. Mobility was almost impossible. I don't know if you guys have ever been in a room that you weren't allowed to leave for days on end. With nothing to do, it is a horrible form of torture. It doesn't seem like it, but I'm telling you, it is. When you have no possibility of mobility, it becomes torture. You'd rather get beaten. So Solzhenitsyn says this. For the first few minutes of this, you were convinced that you'd not be able to stand an hour. But by some miracle, a human being would indeed sit out 5 days, maybe more, acquiring in the course of it an illness that would last him the rest of his life. And then standing. Simple but excruciating torture, and I'm convinced has something to do with mocking the church, because we stand for everything. The victim was simply be forced to stand for days on end. If you stand for days on end and then collapse, you can't walk for a long time afterward. You're talking about extreme joint compression, muscle strain, back problems, and God forbid you're overweight. You're a newcomer, for example. Back problems, permanent damage. Again, you don't think of these things as tortures. They all seem pretty normal. But taken to an extreme, they are diabolical. Solzhenitsyn says, sometimes even one day of standing is enough to deprive a person of all of his strength and force him to testify to anything at all. And it comes down to the following. It comes down to depersonalization. The process of depersonalization, the destruction of one's identity, this was the final result, a long, drawn-out form of psychological torture. It's based on beatings and starvation, but certainly not as direct as those things. No one in the Gulag had privacy. I mean, even in American jails, you have privacy. They're always being watched by someone. Cells were deliberately stuffed with inmates, slept almost piled on top of one another. The toilet was a hole in the floor. Even there, eyes were on you. On top of that, communication among inmates was forbidden, though very difficult to enforce. The resources for prisoners were so scarce. The system then would create a severe state of competition among inmates, destroying any sense of solidarity. And remember, all of this is not done voluntarily. You know, when you're starving, you start eating whatever you can. You're not, you have no control over it. Your body takes over at this point. So, hundreds of these camps dotted the USSR. These methods of torture, outside of a handful of explicitly right-wing or sometimes ethnic nationalists, especially Ukrainians and Poles, works and books, totally unknown in the West. You contrast that to South Africa, and you see the contemptuous nature of Western liberalism. Within those conditions, you have three uprisings. This has been done before, not the way I do it, but Nulisk, Wokuta, and Kinjir, all after Stalin's death, which should not be a surprise to you. When Stalin dies, they had been brought up on this diet of Stalin's different. He's not really a communist. No, I have a whole book showing that Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, the exact same policy, the exact same enforcement mechanism. The only difference is some had more resources than others. Early USSR was different from Stalin's USSR. But when Stalin died, there was this sense that it's very possible things are going to change. There was a, you know, in Khrushchev's era, there was some amnesty for those convicted of some classes of political crimes, not actual crime. These rebellions all took after, became a big deal after Stalin's death. They expected, the amnesty was declared for certain people, and that raised expectations. There is nothing more dangerous. Any political scientist worth his salt knows that there's nothing more dangerous than raised expectations that don't get met. This is how government gets overthrown. Wokuta was in the far north, July of 1953. Pretty much coal was their main purpose. 60,000 inmates, overwhelmingly political. They were there because they were dissidents. Beria was arrested. That gave even more hope. People were thinking that now Stalin is gone, now Beria is gone, things are going to change. And, you know, it's such torture, like the sofa thing. They bring a guy who's been tortured for all this time, they put him on a beautiful sofa, and then take him off. You know, it's just done for its own sake. In many cases. The problem here, at this particular prison, was the influx of Ukrainian nationalists. That was the catalyst for rebellion. On top of that, you had a group of Baltic nationalists moved in. And you had Red Army POWs. Remember, Stalin's policy was that if you were captured by the Germans and sent to one of their camps, you come back, you're automatically in the camps. That's why Solzhenitsyn went to the camp. He was in a German, he was an artilleryman. He was in a German camp for much of the war, I think after 43. And when he was released, the war was over, he was put in a camp. This is how that all started. The average sentence was 10 to 15 years of this, by the way, in that particular camp. June the 30th, the first stirrings of this violence, this uprising, were to begin. They were demanding amnesty for those who were there strictly for political crimes. Inmates began attacking guards on not too long after that. Then they went on strike. They simply refused to work. That's we're talking about August 19th. They refused to negotiate with anyone but the Communist Party hierarchy from Moscow. Talking with the camp administration was meaningless. Even local administration would know. They wanted to talk to the people who created this system. They created their action committee, and they were very good at this. All the camps were very literate politically. And what they demanded was this. Now Stalin is gone, they want a review of all their cases. They wanted removal of bars from their windows. They wanted to be able to correspond with family. They wanted food with maggots in it removed, which apparently was a big deal. They wanted letters and numbers removed from their identification because that was a huge part of depersonalization. And, of course, restraint from guards who realized they could do whatever they wanted. This is what the left does when they have no one to stop them. These were politically competent men. They realized that only Central Moscow Communist Party people could do anything. 3,000 of the 56 were on strike. And you had all these different populations. You had the OUN, the AK Polish, the Baltic Nationalists. They had their own committees. It was extremely well organized. Communist Party shows up, having no intention of doing it. You see, it's not as if anyone was watching. You see how, you know, Putin is watched. You see how South Africa was watched in the 70s and 80s. You see how North Korea's, you know, that didn't exist here. This is why I say that there was no Cold War. The U.S. had no, there was no interest in this. No one knows anything about this stuff. But boy, every school kid will tell you all about Nelson Mandela, who was not a good man, as you well know. They know that no one's watching. They knew that every university in America was backing them. They knew that every intellectual, unless they were specifically right-wing, was backing them. The literary establishment in London was backing them. They could do no wrong. So they promised a 9-hour workday. They promised family correspondence. They promised the, and these were also demands, that they can send money back to their family with their wage increases. All the rest of it. 9,000 cases to be reviewed, which was a big, all these uprisings had that as one of the main demands. None of these, of course, were ever implemented. And it didn't take long for these committees, who were ignored, who were censored out of the Soviet press, who were censored out of the Western press, they had nowhere to go. They ended up killing a couple of guards. And morale, once they began to fight back physically, morale did increase. The strike went to 15,000 men shortly thereafter. Communist Party reps show up again. They claim to review cases. They want to do all of this. But then they were told from Moscow, we are not. No one is watching us. We can do as we please. The arrests began. I'm not sure where they were going to be sent. I guess there's a super gulag that they were going to be sent to. Their version of the hole, which I can't imagine what that would be. Ultimately, 53 inmates were killed and almost 200 were wounded in the crackdown, the work stoppages. And, of course, no one on planet Earth said anything. No major changes were made. Nothing was ever done. And that was the end of it. These men were tortured worse than ever before. So now at the same time, we go to Norilsk, which was a nickel mining camp within the Gulag system. That's actually above the Arctic Circle, so it's a lot of fun to be there. Here you had a massive set of camps, about 100,000 men. Yeah, I went to go get my marriage license the other day. I got to tell you something. The county courthouse here in western Pennsylvania, they have this huge mural. And it says to all the men and women killed in all the wars since America's been founded here in Pennsylvania. Men and women. Of course, there's not a single female name on that thing. Idiots. Men and women. Moron. Not a single female. Oh, Jesus. Anyway. Norilsk. Huge. Now, they had a hole, which I don't know, you know, what do they call it in America? Not protective custody, but disciplinary custody, whatever the hell they call it. Of the 100,000 inmates, you had like half of them in even worse conditions. So they're being disciplined for something. You had 35 camps in the Arctic Circle, all under this same directorate. But the same kind of people. The only difference is you didn't have the Ukrainians there. The Ukrainians, wherever they've gone, have, to their credit, been the catalyst for all kinds of uprisings in the camp. There was also a Kazakh influx, about 2,000 of them, another big factor in the uprising. These are the people who brought the idea of revolution based on nationalist ideas. So 1953, we're talking about the end of August. This begins. It was sporadic at first. Depending on who you talk to, even goes as early as June of that year. No amnesty, no way out, no one cares. And I'm going to say this over and over again. Whenever you have a right-wing power that's allegedly doing something wrong, you have the entire world, directed by this Judaic Great Reset, New World Order nonsense, watching it and making up stuff and everything else. When the left does it, far worse, in reality, not usually the left is fantasy, but in reality, they're ignored. Because to them, there is no soul, there is no spirit. Men are just matter in motion. What the hell difference does it make if they suffer and die? The demands were very similar. The lowering of the work duties, fewer hours, review of cases, removal of women and children. There were a handful of women and children who were being tortured here. Same demands for negotiations and safe passage for the negotiator. The terms were excessive. They needed to be cut down. The freeing of war veterans who were there just because they were in German camps. Healthcare, education. The punishment of MVD agents who were just over the top with their methods of dealing with things. This on and on. It's pretty much the same set of demands. And the one thing to keep in mind with all of these, you have a tremendous competence and literacy in political theory, despite their weakened state. They also demanded a release of those who had relatively short sentences, which were very few, and the release of those who had just a short time left. And many of these people were, in bad shape to begin with. And Nurlisk, very similar to the one before. Negotiating only with the central committees of the party, the party coming in, knowing full well that no one is watching, simply told them what they wanted to hear. This was a more or less spontaneous event. The organization occurred only after the work stoppage started and guards were kicked out of the camp. By the way, there's a new movie on Attica coming up. Talk about a backwards world here. I have a paper on Attica on my Patreon. And they refused to work until the Communist Party officials show up. And each camp, well, I think a few, 30, 35, each camp had its own committee system and its own leader. See, initially, they took over the camp radio and they began broadcasting very anti-Soviet nationalist ideas, realizing that no one was paying attention. They then realized we have to deal within the system, so that changed very quickly to pro-Soviet ideas. And you hear this all the time, dissidents. I've read so much Samizdat, so many dissidents, in the original. And it's really, it's not like what American conservatives do. And we can't blame, we're not blaming them. They did what they had to do. But they talk about how wonderful Lenin was and how terrible that the Gulag system has so perverted the wonderful ideas of the founding fathers of the USSR. It's idiotic. No more idiotic than the American patriots talk about the founding fathers like they know anything. But they use those terms. I mean, I've seen 1,000 times how wonderful Lenin was, but how terrible Stalin was. That ridiculous myth invented in the American university. But if you're a dissident, that's the tack you have to take. All in all, 16,000 participated over the course of 2 months. All kinds of promises were made by the party, all of it a lie. They began to attack inmates, the army was brought in, it was over by August 4th, and about 100 were killed. And that was it. No one said a word. No one notices. To this day, no one knows who these people are. And the final is the Khinjir. This is in Kazakhstan. And the Kazakh camps made famous by Solzhenitsyn and the cancer ward. Can you imagine? You're sentenced to these camps. Then you get cancer. What? And then he gets sent to Kazakhstan, as you do when you get cancer. Apparently they have an oncology thing down there. He talks about the only female doctors at his particular Kazakh camp, which I never quite understood if that was real. But this is in a very different kind of environment. They were not freezing. these guys did. They mostly focused on construction, which I think almost all of them did some version of construction, but extracting ore, not just iron, but all kinds of ores. You had tremendous punishment and torture, as I've described, but that never quite motivates people to do anything. You had high discipline, low production. Now, this one's a bit later. It was starting in 1954. And because of the terrible administration, they were way behind in their quotas. Construction plans were behind by about 40%, and you had, in terms of iron ore and other forms of mining, 400,000 tons lower than the quota. In this sense, inmates did have quite a bit of power. But you're talking about urban Communist Party members, you're talking about young Jews, you're talking about people who really only understood violence in one form or another. So they came out with this incredible plan to control the... Here it is. And you're gonna see, with all these, I'm hoping you're seeing echoes of how domestic politics works in America. By that winter, they decided that they were going to bring in actual criminals. This was mostly a political camp. That they were going to force the political people, who were kind of just normal guys, in with actual criminals, you know, murderers and rapists and everything else. Kind of like, you know, some of us might be considered today. And the transfer was finally done in April of 54. But they brought in, as it turns out, about, and not just the criminals too, about half were Ukrainian. And the other half were from Latvia. And you had other actual Communist Party members who had fallen afoul of the regime. And if you read Gulag Archipelago, he and other, the Red Wheel, Solzhenitsyn talks about that type there. Russians were only the third largest group in this Kazakh camp. But the main focus fell on the Ukrainians. So in this case, ethnic nationalism was the main cause, or at least the catalyst for it all. And making matters worse, for the guards, they were mostly from Western Ukraine. So they were speaking a Ukrainian, of course, with a nice mixture of Polish, maybe even a little bit of German, which meant that the guards couldn't understand them. This is why the lingua franca of the camp ended up being, Polish / Ukrainian. This was extremely well organized. And of course, bringing in violent criminals, forcing them to intermingle with the nationalists and all the others, regular political criminals, was a disaster, because the criminals were very quickly converted. These were pickpockets, you know, maybe a few murders. You know, these people, who knows how their trial really was? Who knows if these people were actually guilty? But they assumed that they just end up killing them all, using the violent criminals to kill their enemy. Why do you think the French revolutionaries, the Soviets, always, the Black Lives Matter, their first demand is to open up the prisons? And they used COVID as an excuse to let murderers out and made sure that you couldn't buy guns in city limits. This is no accident. This is the exact same thing. By May of 54, the shooting began. Remember, the guards, when you talk about the concentration camps in Germany, such as they were, you had a minuscule handful of guards, especially in 44-45, because every man was needed in the front. So, of course, the concentration camps were, in fact, self-organized. And you had the same thing here. And that's why it was so dangerous. This shows the level of security that the Soviets had coming out of World War II, because they knew that the trading, the rebuilding of the Soviet economy was done by the United States. All of their debt was forgiven under the Marshall Plan. Today would be about $1 trillion, all wiped out of the books. That was their Marshall Plan that no one talks about. No one talks about. I might be the only one to ever mention the fact that while the Soviet Union was offered Marshall Plan aid, by the way, I thought we were enemies. They refused it on the grounds they weren't going to open up the books. And very possibly to see all the American investment, which would have been a problem, I think. Yeah, this is why McCarthy was silenced. This is what he was going to go public about. So, again, and I'll repeat this. These guards and Communist Party officials, they are aware that no one's watching them, that the world is backing them, that the people who are in camps are fascist, violent psychopaths, and they belong there. And no one was going to defend them. None of them had any real representation. These were all kangaroo trials, and I can only imagine maybe even their criminal cases were the same. But it is shocking. And of course, our people could never do this. But the tremendous, all three of these uprisings, the political organization was almost innate. These were spontaneous. There's no way for anything else to be the case. It's that they're in prison, and they're in a bad shape in prison. If they're not sick just by something else, with bad food, they're sick from exhaustion and everything else we talked about. And I did this list of tortures in the gulag. That's maybe 5% of what they came up with. But the point was as much psychological as anything else. May 15th of 54, this is when the shooting began. Criminals apparently knew their way around a gun, and some of these guys, well, most of them had been drafted before anyway, found the armory the guards had access to and broke into it. All told, there were 13 deaths and I think about 100 wounded. The inmates were now armed, and the administration withdrew all of its men and all of its forces, which were very small to begin with, from the camp as a whole. Now they were controlling the camp entirely. Now they tried to get back in by claiming that they were just going to be repairing things. I mean, these stupid pretexts, you know. And they really believed, well, these guys are at the level of animals anyway. We could just tell them anything and they'll let us in. And they were told to go to hell. They had all of these very poor pretexts to come back in. And of course, they were dressed up as Ukrainians. And, you know, they did this stuff all the time. You know, Americans would buy it. These people would not. The overall leader was Kunetsov, who was a Russian, and they elected him kind of like, you know, the president of Hungary during the Red Terror. Stalin said, look, the entire Hungarian party is Jewish, every last one of you. If you elect a president, make sure that he's not Jewish. And it took them about a year, not even less than a year, a few months to find a non-Jew. And they made him president, who, of course, had no powers. It's similar here. Kunetsov was a Russian in a camp largely controlled by both Ukrainian and the Baltic nationalists, as well as a Kazakh element. You know, the last two, this one and the Norilsk rebellions, did have a Kazakh element. And we can't discount their abilities in the political realm. They didn't want this to look all Ukrainian, so they elected Kunetsov. But not only that, they were competent enough to elect subcommittees. They ran the camp actually very well. Once the guards were gone, once the administration was gone, you know, once the menorah was pulled up from the central square, they ran the camp competently. They maintained ethnic separatism. They had an overall committee, but then different aspects like health and drainage, that kind of thing, work, they had subcommittees for. These were all elected, and things, you know, looked up, at least briefly. I want to repeat myself. They know that there's not many places to go. They're not getting support from abroad. I wonder if there was some Islamic movement towards them, if they figured out a way to... I mean, I was a part of the Ukrainian church for a long time in Lincoln, and those guys had smuggled all kinds of things into Ukraine in the 80s. I have the feeling that there may have been some Muslim countries that were involved, because this is in Kazakhstan, in assisting the strikers, but it wasn't, you know, certainly not sufficient to matter. Like a lot of Soviets, they knew how to use propaganda. This is something, unfortunately, their royal family, sometimes generals, don't understand. God, your typical, you know, YAF conservative in America, they have no concept of propaganda. They think everyone fights fair. You know, they think the media is objective and they're just being, you know, taken over by liberal. Like, this is something new to them. You know, but they should be objective. And normally we can hold them to that standard. We're going to bring them to court. You know, they believe this garbage. We'll just elect the right people. And that'll change everything. You know, the old Rush Limbaugh early 90s kind of mentality. But they knew here. Now, the American conservative lives in comfort. He's spoiled. He's ignorant. He's terrified. These people lived in the most vile environment that a human being can create. That's the difference. But they knew enough to organize, and again, in at least two camps, taking over the radio was a big deal. They did kind of what the South Koreans did. They attached leaflets to balloons. Don't know where they got them, but they must have sent thousands of them to the north and to Islamic countries in the south, hoping to get their message out. Because they knew that they were negotiating from a position of weakness. Temporarily, they did have strength. They were involved with some serious mining and construction. And you had some skilled labor there. But that was only very short term. This is the most painful aspect, is that they knew that no one cared. The nationalists, anti-communists, whether they be from Ukraine or Kazakhstan, the Baltics, hated the Western world. I've read everything that Bandera ever wrote. Very few people can say that. He hated the West. He hated liberalism. The West was a slight variant of Soviet Marxism. They pretended to have elections. They knew that they were trading with the Soviets, that they were building camps, that they were not only did they build the GE built the Soviet electrical grid, that they were constantly repairing it. They were involved in the new computer era. They were involved, you know, that all came from the West. Everything. Who the heck did they have there? And if they did have anybody, they're educated in the U.S. You had military stuff being shipped over there. An entire automotive industry came from Henry Ford's plant in Ukraine. They knew that no one cared. The Ukrainians, the Latvians, everyone knew that the West was pro-Soviet. Yes, they would complain when the empire got too big, when they threatened to cut the dollar out of world trade. But there was nothing wrong with Marxism as such. Every university were throwing students out for rejecting it. They were far harsher with students in the U.S. over Marxism than they were in the Soviet Union. You had tons of patriots starting in the 1970s attending universities and causing trouble. You know, this was something that we have no conception of right now. But because of the fact that they were from a position of weakness, the party did, all three of these uprisings, the exact same thing. They wanted Communist Party central officials to come here. And it was a charade in all three cases. In other words, they pretty much had this planned out. Clearly the three camps were not in communication with one another. You're talking about roughly the same period of time, from 53 to 57. The demands were very similar. The demands were born from necessity. The demands were born from tremendous internal weakness, a physical weakness. And they had a plan for this. And they've been doing this for some time. Lots of promises were made. Yegorov was a Jew, the main negotiator for Moscow. And he went on and on and on about how they're going to fix things. We need you guys happy to work. They demanded. They put it in writing and refused. Then they do what they did best. The Communist Party sowed dissent amongst, and they know how to do this very well. It could be ethnic, it could be religious, whatever it might be. They send a beautiful woman in there and watch the inmates fight over. There's a million ways to do it. That's actually, by the way, not an uncommon tactic. Have a political meeting of all right-wing men. Send one hot girl in there. See what happens. See the beta screaming. It's like they become autistic all of a sudden. They'll slaughter each other for her. I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen recently for her attention. Oh my God, it's such a, and the women normally are not in favor of those things. They support whatever they need to, but they know that there's a lot of good guys there who are virtuous and could be taken advantage of. So they, you know, now, there are some exceptions. I know girls who I've known for a long time in this movement, including my future wife, been in the movement for a long time. There are, I hope, exceptions. But you do have opportunists. These are methods by which the Communist Party sowed dissent in getting these people to kill. Well, no, those are a million different things. You could take one faction of them, promise them release, promise them all kinds of things, and then send them back. No different than with the mafia, how they deal with long drug sentences or anything else. They start ratting on each other. It's not that hard to do, especially when you're dealing with guys who are at their wit's end anyway. The meetings amounted to nothing. In fact, they started scheduling meetings just for the sake of propaganda. No one ever actually showed up. The whole thing was a lie. June 26th, the infantry was mobilized, and an armored corps, not a corps, an armored, a small armored unit, I think 5 tanks total, were used. So this was, not even a platoon. 46 were killed, 200 were badly injured, and I'm sure they did okay, because, the hospitals there and the gulag camps are wonderful, so I'm sure they all survived. And, those who, and all three of these uprisings, the heads of the committees, were all sentenced to death. Which is an odd thing, because they were going to die anyway, but in this case, they died more quickly. So I'm not sure if that's a punishment or not. And so you see with these three uprisings, you understand the nature of the gulag system. It primarily was an economic and disciplinary organization. It was Judaic from top to bottom. Solzhenitsyn has written on this in 200 Years Together, the Archipelago, the Wed Wheel, on and on and on and on. There's no getting out of it. It had a religious Judaic core to it. American companies were involved in the construction, certain parts of it anyway. Those who were non-American, native-born Russians, learned from Americans and Englishmen how to do this. People don't understand that. The U.S. was never at war with the USSR as such. Certainly not like today with Russia. Not even close. The minute Russia was no longer a left-wing force in politics, the U.S. then went to war against it. These threats were never made against the USSR. That's happening now. It was never done. There were no sanctions on the USSR ever, 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 ever. Mao was slaughtering tens of millions of people. Not a sanction, not a peep. And anyone who complained and who said anything were treated slightly better than what Mao did with his opponents. You notice that these uprisings have a lot in common. The demands were similar. The review of cases is common because they knew that the system was ridiculous, no different than ours. Staying out of the court, now we had, I think there was one guy, I had advised this and someone did take me up on it. I had advised this several times that because this is, the January 6th people, they were being persecuted. They did nothing wrong. They did everything right, in fact. One of them, at least one of them, went to the Belarusian embassy and applied for asylum and received it. So people do listen to me. Staying out of the law courts is something that we have to avoid it. I mean, minor things. Staying out of the law courts is extremely important. And it's no different than the USSR. They demanded the cases be reviewed because there was no case. They were sentenced because they were inconvenient. We have people with long sentences being tortured, being in isolation, and American prisoners right now who are there because they're one of us and for no other reason. They talk about the violence of the right wing. I've been over every single case of every nationalist attacked in America. I read the newspaper articles, and none of them were racial, none of them were even political. Usually they were drug deals, usually they were an alcoholic, a bar fight. Then they find out, the press finds out the guy was a member of, I don't know, League of the South or something like that, and then becomes of right-wing violence organized against a minority. That's how it works. And it's no different here. Review of the cases, correspondence with family, some kind of not working 18 hours a day, some food that didn't have maggots in it, some food that actually was food, some opportunity for education. I mean, basic, very similar, and all were rejected. They were accepted loudly, and it was put in prompt how the reforms, how wonderful the Khrushchev era is going to be. And the Western, journalists are writing this out, with big wide eyes, using all their critical faculty, and still being promoted today. No one knows who these people are. No one knows who these and these guys were aware that no one cared. Joe McCarthy, there was a handful. The Russian presence in America was very ineffectual because, number one, they were tailed by the FBI. All the communists weren't, but Russian nationalists and royalists were tailed by the FBI. I have many of their FBI files in my own file. Solzhenitsyn had one. I don't know, a whole bunch of them. Solzhenitsyn was tailed by the FBI. They were going to tell the KGB where he lived. The U.S. was never anti-communist. Drop that myth from your vocabulary. They built the Soviet Union. Trotsky and Stalin admitted it more than once. And, of course, Trotsky was one of the richest men in the world by the time he was murdered. We know exactly how much he was worth at the time of his death. He was no Rothschild, but he was a multi-billionaire. All stolen goods from Russia. Of course, not being a Russian himself, he didn't care. Stop using these tortures on women and children. Release prisoners that don't have any good reason to be here, like those who were simply captured by the Germans. They tried in vain. They begged. It's like, the Joe Rogan apology. Oh, shut the hell up, you illiterate. God almighty. Has someone told him that apologies don't work? Oh, God. He can go to hell. These, I don't know what the hell he is politically. I don't care. I don't really pay attention. But you see the similarities between these camps as a microcosm and the Western, which is ultimately a communist world, except a private sector monopoly rather than the state really being ineffectual in general. You see the make-believe issues. And the fact that if we were to be sent to prison tomorrow, we would be forgotten the day after tomorrow. The regime, as of now, in America anyway, does not have organized resistance. Oh, these patriot groups. I'll tell you right now, these are the first people. A state trooper comes knocking on the door, please hand over your guns. What are they going to do? Barricade themselves in their house? I hate these bumper stickers that say, oh, fry it for my cold dead. Oh, shut the hell up. You're going to meekly hand over whatever you're told. Stop this. And you're going to do it because no one's going to have your back. At least in these camps, they did have each other's back, and they went to their deaths. But the other thing, at least in two of these camps, ethnic nationalism was essential. Ethnic nationalism is tightly wound up with religion. It has to be. That's what it is. That's what created the self-sacrifice. That's what created the motivation. That's what created the committee. That's why they were so well organized. You can't base a movement, even in a camp, you can't base a movement that we're unhappy and we're being treated badly. They'll turn on each other in a minute if they're promised something better. That can never be the foundation of political action in a camp. It has to be based on something positive, the building of national anti-communist societies. And they were doing it. They were actually running these camps for a short time. Turns out, of course, economic production wasn't really the point. They knew they would get whatever they needed from the U.S. They knew that. The U.S. would direct it, Germany, and they were all invested in the Soviet Union. They knew that they would get, they could slaughter farmers in the early part of the revolution. They knew the U.S. would aid them with food. It didn't make any difference. The whole thing was a scam, and everyone knew it. Joe McCarthy was silenced because he was going to talk about the American companies who created the USSR, and he had receipts and everything else, as did, thank God, the occasionally brilliant guy from the Hoover Institute, whose name, for some weird reason, Anthony Sutton. So these are sad cases, and only now are some of their names, some of these camps, some of these struggles are being brought to light for the first time. And in and of itself, it's a sad commentary. And I think you guys have enough imagination to realize why I'm bringing this up now. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I truly appreciate it. Please donate to my cause. And I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.